Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. We have the privilege to be joined by Dr. Chagai Schlesinger, and we're going to be talking about Rabben Tzion Uzziel's approach on whether there is such an institution in Judaism as an appeals court for the judiciary. And Dr. Schlesinger is an excellent choice for this. This is, of course, part of your area of research. Dr. Schlesinger is a legal scholar, currently a visiting scholar at New York University Law School. Hence, we have the schluss of having you here in Stamford. His research areas are law and religion, constitutional law, and Jewish law. Dr. Schlesinger's PhD, written at the Hebrew University, deals with the regulation of Jewish religious activity in Israel. And before writing his dissertation, Dr. Schlesinger clerked for a few years in the renowned Israeli Supreme Court. So, of course, it's also pretty timely to have you, given all of your not just immediate legal knowledge, but also your general experience. And I'm very excited to hear why you wanted to talk about Rabben Tzion Uzziel in particular, and why this topic in particular.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Moshe. Thank you for having me. It's a very interesting opportunity, and I'm very delighted to speak on this topic. So you asked two questions: why Rabbi Uzziel, and why the rabbinical court, or the court of appeals? So let me start with the second question about the topic, and then I'll go to the figure, okay? So I think this is a landmark tshuva regarding the challenges and the opportunities of modernizing Jewish law, and I'll soon explain what I mean by that. Already going to the second question, Rabbi Uzziel was a prominent figure within this process. I'm not sure that this teshuvah is a good example of his whole broad approach to this question, but it's a very interesting one. And to give an introduction to this question, what do I mean by saying modernizing Jewish law or religious law? Let me start not by the historical case that this teshuva is talking about, which occurred between 1918 and 1921, this episode, which I will return and explain soon, but let's just give our listeners the outcome. How does rabbinical court, this rabbinical court that the teshuva is talking about, operate today in Israeli legal system? Because I think it's very important to understand what this process of modernization of the judiciary, how did it play out at the end? So Israeli law, I'm sure most listeners know, is a secular law, it's a civil law, and we have courts that operate the laws that the parliament, the Knesset, enact. So if we have a contract and we argue about it, we go to the court, which decided the case according to contract law that the Israeli parliament enacted. What happens if two guys happen to be religious and want to go to Din Torah? They can do that. They go to a Beis Din. It's a private Beis Din, and the framework in which it operates is arbitration, and that's similar to what happens also here in America, and I guess almost everywhere where Jews or other religious people want to adjudicate their case according to their own legal system, religious legal system. That's not the case regarding to family law in Israel. Family law, which is, right, and marriage, divorce, and all the issues that that come out from a divorce, are adjudicated in rabbinical courts if you're Jewish, and in Muslim courts if you're Muslim, and in Christian courts if you're Christian.
Okay. What do you do if you're, what do you do if you're Hindu or something
That's
else?
That's a good question. So this system, its origins begin in the Ottoman Empire. Okay, I'm going to do this very generally speaking, but this idea that each religious sect gets its autonomy in adjudicating religious issues is an Ottoman invention, okay, or operation, okay. It didn't work as it were as it is working today. And in 1918, when the British government, okay, came into the land of Israel and the mandate that they got, eventually, they kept this system, but as I'm going to explain now, tried to systemize it and modernize it and make it work like a modern legal system. Okay.
So the funny thing is that the way you're explaining it now is that there's this distinction between civil law and ritual religious law. And when I was looking through the tshuva, you were very merciful. It's the first tshuva at the beginning of Chelek Choshe Mishpat, and it goes on Netzach Netzachim forever. I'm very grateful you pointed me to the Iker primary parts of the tshuva. So I noticed that toward the end, in his conclusion, he says, "Ein ani maskim la'osa chaluka ha-musris ha-medinis." There's no like distinction between these things. It's Torah Yisrael, he Torah ha-musav, or Torah ha-chevra. The same Torah that regulates marriage regulates our civil law as well. So this whole distinction seems to be artificial almost.
Right. So you're quoting, I think, at least in my opinion, the most important sentence of the tshuva. And I'm going to return to that. This sentence is a reply to a different rabbi who wrote on this topic and made this distinction. And I'm going to return to that in a few minutes. So just let me, I just to your point, when Rabbi Uziel writes this, this is information, okay? We don't know how the system will end up. And rabbis like Rabbi Uziel advocated for a whole legal system which will operate according to Din Torah. That's how they envisioned the Jewish state that will become as a state that is operating according, at least to some extent, according to Din Torah, also in civil manners. So when he writes this, this distinction is in debate, okay? It exists already, but it's in debate. Okay.
And just one more clarifying question. I know that he became eventually the Rishon LeZion. Was he already serving in this capacity at the time of writing this?
Not yet. That happened to be in the 30s. But he was at the time the rabbi of Jaffa. Let's get into the figure. Rabbi Uziel was born in 1880 in Jerusalem. A Sephardic Jerusalem rabbi. He became in 19, I think 11 or that area, the rabbi of Jaffa. Wrote this teshuva just before he went to Greece for 2 years, rabbi of Thessaloniki, and returned here and became part of the system that he advocated against in this teshuva.
Right? Wow.
And that actually made him change his mind a little bit, and I'll try to talk about that in the last minutes that we have. So, the system as it today, I'm returning to 2023 for a second. Okay, so if you have a case of a dispute about some dispute regarding divorce, how to divide the assets, so on. You have to go to a rabbinical court, even if you are an atheist, okay? And their decision is a state organ decision, exactly as a civil court would decide on contract law. And if you're not happy with the result, you can appeal, okay, to the higher court, which is the court of appeal, which is called in Israel Beit Adin Gadol. Okay, and it's not a mistake that, that when they enacted, when they established it, they called it Beit Adin Gadol, which is referring to this, right, to the Sanhedrin. But right, but it's just a court of appeal. That's all it is. We don't have three. It's two. It's a two system. You go to the first Beit Din, Beit Din, regional Beit Din, and if you appeal, you appeal to the Beit Adin Gadol. And now the question is there such a thing as an appeal in Jewish law? Okay.
Right. So the first thing that comes to my mind is the whole setup that Yisro advised Moshe Rabbeinu about, you know, you can't deal with all the questions, so we'll set up some lower courts and the tougher ones will get punted up to you eventually. So what would be the novelty? Why would this seemingly be at odds with how the Jewish judicial system ought to work?
Okay, so there are some sources like the one you pointed out, the story of Yitro, that have a concept of higher authority or higher tribunals, but it is not the kind of hierarchy that is that happens in an appeal, in the sense that in the appeal you argue against a decision, and not the judge thinks that his knowledge is not enough, or that the question is difficult, and passes it on to a higher court.
So you're saying the difference is who initiates it, meaning if a dayan, if a judge or a lower beis din says we don't know how to handle this, we're going to punt it up to the next level. That's one thing, but for one of the litigants to say, I don't really trust the judgment of this court, you know, what kind of chutzpah is that? What right does he have to assess the validity of the judgment of this beis din? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And the point is, I think, I think that Rav Uziel understood the problem in the appellate system is that instead of having a rabbinical authority that is based on the virtue of the dayan, okay, on his righteousness and on his striving to justice, it is based on his institutional rank and his state-based position, okay? And that he figured to be a transformation in the nature of rabbinical authority.
Oh, wow.
And that was a transformation that he was truly bothered by and tried to oppose in this teshuva.
Just to clarify, his issue is the fusion of the religion with the state. I just want to make sure I understand that point.
It is very much connected. And in the last paragraphs of the teshuva, he says, you need to understand something about the judiciary. All right, the judiciary is maybe superficially you think that the judiciary is an organ of the state, but there is judicial independence in the sense that we don't need states the sovereignty helps the courts in an administrative level, okay, in prosecuting its decisions and so on. But the true basis of judicial authority in the Jewish tradition is that the people have trust in the justices. And for that, we don't need any state. And in the second, you involve the state, you endanger that, because people start to think that their authority is because that the state said so, but truly we can switch this person with anybody else.
So that's really funny because I totally get the argument. My sense, now you're actually from Eretz Yisrael and I think in the Da'at Yilmi world there, but my sense as an outsider was always that much of the more devout religious Zionist community, Dafka wanted to push for the fusion of religion and state. What he's espousing here, based on your articulation, it's almost reminiscent of Leibovich's approach, which he was seemed to be devoutly pro-halakha and religion, but also is very wary of the state taking control and becoming its own religious entity unto itself. Is there like a similar kind of philosophy?
I think you are correct in assuming that this teshuvah is not a typical teshuvah of a Zionist rabbi. Eventually in this battle he lost. Not only he lost, but he joined he served as a supreme as a Beit HaDin HaGadol Dayan for many years and understood eventually why it is required. But let me go back, following your point, to the story itself and how this Beis Din was initiated. And there you will find the ideological framework that you were talking about. So the thing is, the British government came here and said, okay, every religious sect gets to adjudicate its own community. They had a problem with the Muslim community because until the Ottoman Empire collapsed, that was state courts. They were Muslim courts. So they now had to turn into a religious minority and in this modern framework. But put that aside, when they came to the Jewish community, so they were encountered also by internal struggles between seculars and religious people in Israel, in Eretz Israel, that were debating about the scope of a rabbinical jurisdiction. Okay, so this modernization of the Ottoman system, of the millet system, that's how it's called, turned religious adjudication versus secular adjudication to a zero-sum game. What do I mean? If beforehand in the Ottoman system, it's true that the Ottomans allowed rabbinical courts to adjudicate Jewish people, but Jewish people weren't obligated to go to religious courts. They could have gone to Ottoman courts as well. But now, as I said, the system as it developed means today, in 2023, that if you are a Jewish, you must get divorced by three rabbis, even if you are an atheist. So the scope of religious, Jewish religious adjudication became a very heated topic, and the British wanted to grant this authority, didn't want it to be too much exclusive. And one of the issues, I'm not getting into the whole picture, but one of the issues is that they pressured the rabbis to initiate a court of appeals. It's a British initiative.
It's an external pressure.
An external pressure. This is how the story begins. But it's also an internal pressure, because even before the British government started pushing towards a court of appeals, Zionists, politicians in Israel, secular politicians, also pushed the rabbis to initiate a court of appeals, saying, if you want us to support rabbinical judiciary, you need to make it a modern system. And a modern system requires a court of appeals. And so this is the debate. And the first a person writing about this, rabbinical figure writing on this, and Rav Uziel's tshuva, and it's important to understand that, is a response to him, is a guy named Rabbi Chaim Hirshenson. And Rabbi Chaim Hirshenson is a figure that deserves a podcast for himself. He was also born in Eretz Israel, in Sfat, moved to Turkey, to Istanbul, and from there to the United States and became a rabbi in Hoboken, New Jersey. Oh. And he sits there in New Jersey, 1919, hearing about this debate in Eretz Israel, and he's an enthusiastic Zionist. Okay, he moves to the United States because he didn't find his place in the social religious environment in Eretz Israel. He had very unique ideas about the coming Jewish state, and he extensively writes about these issues. He has a 6-volume book named Malki Bakodesh, which is a play on Melucha in Kedusha, right? Malki Bakodesh, how to build a state, a Melucha, which is according to a halacha. And he hears about this debate through the press and writes a very long tshuva. If this was long for you, so his tshuva is, I would guess, like 3 times longer. Okay. And this tshuva, the idea of his tshuva, I'm not getting into is the halachic discussion and his argument, but his idea is to support the initiative of a court of appeals. And there he makes this division between what you quoted, the Mishpat HaMedini and Mishpat HaMusari. And he says in his introduction, it's a few astonishing sentences. And he says basically, you know what? All the advocates for appellate court blame our courts that they are not modern. They're right. They're correct. They're not modern. And the reason that they're not modern and there is no appeal in Jewish law doctrine, it's not an incident. It's not an accident. I mean, it's something that's in the DNA of the system. And the idea is that you can construct legal authority in 2 ways, he says, in a musari way, a moral way, which is from bottom to top. Okay, a person has a moral commitment to fulfill the laws because he believes that they are just laws. Okay, and that's one possibility. And the other possibility is mishpat medini. There is a state, and there's laws, and there's enforcement, and there's police, and you stop at the red light not because you think it's a proper thing to do, but because you're afraid to get caught and get punished. Okay, and that's two different kinds of legal authorities. And our Jewish law is heavily based on the first, on the moral acceptance of the laws. Without that, the system could not operate. Okay? The system as it was developed in exile without sovereignty, that's the system. And that's why we don't have appeals, because appeals are built on some sense of a judicial hierarchy. And we don't have that. Our obligation to the laws come from the moral acceptance of these laws and the people who carry them out, the judges. But then he says, so he says, that's right, you're correct. But that's a problem. We can't establish a modern state just based on people's morals. We can't do that. We need to turn out, to shift our sense of authority to the Mishtar HaMedini. And then he says, but that's possible through Jewish law. If you look inside sources, inside Talmudic sources that deal with the Beis Din, you can find opinions that are based on this kind of enforcement. They exist. They're just marginalized. They were marginalized by the postgame through the generations because they weren't able to operate them because we didn't have these mechanisms. Now we need to renew them. And now in the time, how much time do we have left?
We have a few minutes. I'm also hoping This is very fascinating history, by the way, and I never even knew that there was someone in Hoboken, New Jersey, who was part of this major debate. I'm sure the folks in Eretz Yisrael were asking, why is there some guy, I mean, not some guy, some great rabbi in New Jersey dictating to us what to do. Though I am very curious. I do want to get to, before we conclude, that part of your specialty is studying the Israeli judicial system in modern day as well. And there's been a lot of upheaval recently, and many of those who are in the pro-reform camp, which is funny as an American saying pro-reform is the more conservative side because we think of reform Judaism as liberal, but the pro-reform camp, who's politically and religiously and ideologically more conservative, some of them who are coming especially from the religious standpoint are arguing, why do we have this secular court which has a final say? There should be a Beis in Haggadah, there should be a Sanhedrin. And it seemed from at least how you're presenting this Tshuva Mishpatei Uziel that he wanted some kind of division. It's not clear to me if he fundamentally believes in a division, or just that since the state is secular, we can't just start imputing religious significance into it. But be it as it may, what does that mean? What, you know, what's your take on the place of a secular court having the final say at the top of the hierarchy in Israel today, especially from a religious Zionist standpoint, which I would think would want to see halacha as the preeminent system, or perhaps the only system governing us?
Okay, I'll answer this question as much as I can because it's very complicated. Remember, we're talking about a tshuva that was written more than 100 years ago, right? So I'll answer that. I just want to briefly explain what Rabbi Hirshenson was advocating for, and just he sends this tshuva to the Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael, and Rav Uziel, which was opposing this court from the beginning, is responding in here, and he says, if you think that we will, and that's what you quoted before, Ein ani maskim l'ota chaluka, if you think that we can shift from moral obedience of the law to a top-down enforcement, modern state kind of authority, which will include a judicial hierarchy that is built on state institutions and so on. If you think that that will pass without a tremendous change in the way that people will decline their trust in these people, in these judges, in these rabbis, the Dayanim, so you're wrong. If we will do this, so what eventually will happen, and I think that he was correct in this assumption, it really happened, okay, in the state based rabbinical courts, people will stop trust these figures, and they will obey them because the police tells them to obey them, as they obey any other kind of governmental authority. Okay, so that's I think the teshuva, and as I said afterwards, Rabbi Uziel understood that this is a kind of a romantic understanding of modernity. And in fact, if you want the state to have religious systems as part of the state, then you have to surrender your romantic vision of authority.
Right. You have to be pragmatic. If you can't beat him, join him. So eventually he realized he'd have to do the best he could given the circumstance he found himself.
That's how
compromising works. So, okay. So this is a really great discussion about kind of the beginning of the state of Israel And I want to fast forward, as we mentioned, to modern day. Unfortunately, because of the war in Israel, we've been distracted from the judicial overhaul controversy.
Right.
But it's definitely going to circle back around, and I think it might already be circling back around a little bit from what I'm reading. So I'm just curious, as a legal expert, can you just speak a little bit to that, of what your take on the situation is based on our discussion?
Okay, so...
In our 3 minutes we have left.
Right, sorry, in our 3 minutes, there. And I have, of course, many things to say about the overhaul, but in the context that we spoke, and you said people would like to switch the judiciary with a Sanhedrin, I don't think that that's a dominant approach in the people that are participating in this debate. And that's because 100 years passed. And when Rabbi Uziel writes this, he still imagines the possibility of a what we call Medinat Halacha in some sense, right? A halachic state, a state that operates according to Halacha. And people that are in the pro-reform camp, as you called it, and they have conservative and perhaps religious, Zionist religious approaches, would like the judiciary to be to voice more their values, but inside the secular system. Very few people today would think that the system as a secular system is changeable. And that there is inside the political and the social environment in Israel a possibility to reform the system to that extent. Okay, so they would like Supreme Court judges that are religious, and when they have to balance between values, give more weight to religious values, but within the secular system. They don't, right? And as a matter of fact, when you try to give anti-reform arguments that are based on Jewish law, and I tried to do that a few times.
Oh yeah.
like the example of anecdote, right? It's not a real argument, but in Jewish law, the judges appoint judges, right? The Sanhedrin appoints their own fellows, and there is no political intervention in that. So you might say that the system in Israel also needs to let the judges nominate themselves and their
Well, that's what I found also interesting, just thinking from an American standpoint, that Rav Uziel, and I think you're talking about this right now, speaks about the notion of the basic kind of self-regulating themselves. They get to bring on who the next judges will be. And in America, I know, just from my very, what we call balabatish, my Amaretz standpoint, sometimes there could be actual voting in lower courts. In the upper court, it becomes a whole political battle, the Supreme Court to get the president, and then Congress plays all these tricks about who they're going to get onto the court. But what's very fascinating is the notion of Beistin being all these very righteous men who could self-regulate themselves. And I know in the Supreme Court in America today, that's actually a huge debate about ethics oversight for the Supreme Court. There's currently nothing official that really binds them. They came out with something that they said they'll keep to, but there's no real oversight that binds them. And I think from the legal analysis I was listening to, it was that the assumption was they're such righteous people that they could self-regulate themselves. So it's almost the same kind of logic. The only difference is tzaddikim per se.
It is very interesting to compare these issues, and the truth is that it's a very challenging thing to constitute belief and trust, public trust in courts. And when in Israel they give the example of the United States Court as the pro-reform people would say, here, look, this is a good system because the politicians choose the justices.
We got our own problems.
So they have accountability. They have political accountability because the politicians choose them, not like here in Israel that there's not enough a vote for the politicians, as they argue. So you look at the American Supreme Court and you say, well, that's not necessarily the way to constitute public trust. It's not enough that the politicians choose the people. And what Rav Uziel says, and I'm finishing with that, what Rav Uziel says is, we need to constitute public trust in the virtue of the individuals that serve in the court. And if people believe that the people sitting there are righteous people, and the way to do that is to choose the right people. And he says, well, we are experts in that. We know how to choose good judges.
Building the trust is another question. that's the question.
But his fear is, if you put these righteous people in a modern legal institution that makes their authority be based only on their institutional rank, you destroy this kind of public trust that you're trying to constitute.
So this tshuva, this debate that took place at the beginning of the State of Israel, is really something, the principle of the matter is something for us to really think about a lot today as well. Dr. Schlesinger, it's a real pleasure to have you on the podcast. I try to get a mix of rabbis, and also I try to get some academics as well. So I really appreciate you bringing in your legal, judicial, academic, and historical expertise. And it's a real schus to have you with us in the United States. Thank you for sharing your Torah with us. And God willing, looking forward to learning together again soon.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It was a pleasure and very interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.